Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's May 20th, 2018, and welcome to episode 172 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and minimalist operations of computers. I don't know. Anyway, yeah, see, as I said, I never think about what I'm going to say, and that's not good. So, welcome. I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston, and I'm joined today by a single roundtabler in Toronto, Canada, Carrington Vanston. How are you?
I'm excellent. I am a pretty round tabler, so
okay. Yes,
I think it's still in that description, even if it's just me. I'm doing swell. It is a long weekend here in Toronto. Beautiful, sunny, long weekend. Can't beat that.
What is the holiday?
Weirdly, it's the we celebrate Queen Victoria's birthday.
That's okay. That's what I thought. Yeah.
So mostly, it's in Canada. Most of the provinces, Ontario included, we like to have a long weekend every month. So you just come up with 12 reasons why there should be summer, obvious.
Right.
Like, it was like, hey, Christmas, let's have a long weekend, that kind of thing. For May, it's, we call it 2-4, May 2-4. So the 24th of May or thereabouts. And it's because basically we all go get a 2-4 of beer and you go,
yeah,
and you open the cottage. So it's cottage opening weekend. And our excuse is, hey, there used to be a queen. Yeah, sure. You know what? Whatever. Go buy beer. So it's May 2-4 weekend.
Nice. Well,
yep.
Enjoy.
Welcome to the Canadian mentality.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, this is actually, we're recording this on the day that the commencement exercises were held at the university I'm at. So the academic year ended, nothing but lazy summer days ahead.
Is, nice.
Is what I like to think. Not actually true, but it's the time when I get to figure out where, you know, like how to organize all this junk that's been coming in all year, and I haven't had time to do anything but pile it up. So that should be kind of fun.
I've been thinking, just because we're talking about the, it's bugging me, but there is an old song that my dad, who was born in like the 1400s, which is why he's not with us anymore, there used to be a traditional song people would sing about the 24th of May, and it's bugging me that I can't remember. Probably a listener, if a listener knows Canadian things, they will know. And I don't know if it's even Canadian or if it was something from England, who don't seem to celebrate this weekend. And it was something along the lines of, the 24th of May is the Queen's birthday. If we don't get a holiday, we'll all run away. And it was like this thing, right? So I'm pretty sure it goes something like that. But it's like Firecracker Day. So there'll be fireworks tomorrow, and it's all awesome. So lazy days for us too.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember if there was... I kind of think that Quebec had some other name for it, you know, because they wanted the day off, but it was too Anglophilic.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So, but, okay, so we can move on to the host's topic. And
excellent. You are the host, so you must have a topic.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, actually, that's one thing about being the host all the time by default is that all these things are like the host topic and the gift idea.
They're all on you, picking the commercial, all of it. It's your show. Yeah. We're just here to enjoy it.
Well, great.
great for us.
Yeah. That's fun to do. But okay, so there's an article on the Fast Company website called Using the Old Mac OS as Pure Zen. I don't know who wrote it. Who wrote it? Do we know? Mark Wilson. And this is an article that came out just at the end of April. And the premise of it is that essentially the author went and ran old, like, Mac OS, I don't know what, like 6, 7.
Like super old, like in the black and white version. Yeah.
Right. At the Internet Archive under emulation. I was just kind of playing around with it. And was struck by essentially the minimalist essentials that were there, that, you know, everything worked, but it didn't wow you. What was the phrase? I don't know.
Said it makes current phones and computers look like slot machines.
Yeah. And that sounds about right. Or like the Canadian side of Niagara Falls.
Right. Yes.
Yeah, the animation's neither surprise nor delight.
But he means that in a positive way, though. Like, yeah, that it's more stripped down and it's just a computer to be a computer. And I think well, it's a black and white image. I think he's seeing it through rose-colored glasses.
Mm.
See what I did there? It was like a color visual pun.
Yes, very nice.
Yeah, yeah. I'm well bringing done. My A game, Paul.
But yeah, I mean, so the it is. I mean, I've sort of noticed this a little bit myself too. Like when you look at this, like all that stuff is familiar. Like things haven't changed that much. They've just gotten many, many more pixels. They bounce around in weird ways. There's a distraction that this brings to the modern world that was kind of missing back then. And it is a very sort of calming experience to just kind of write a document in Microsoft Word 4.
I completely agree. Now I agree with what he's saying, and I agree with this as a concept that I too long for and am nostalgic for simpler computers. Obviously, otherwise, why am I on this show? So, like, I have a lot of sympathy for this, or empathy. I have one of those pathies for this. And, like, I get it. But I think we're fooling ourselves to say that, like, older operating systems, which, like, yeah, you look at Mac OS 6, or what is it even called, Mac OS then? They keep changing the name on it. I can't remember. But anyway, System 6. You look at System 6, and you look at a modern OS 10/X/whatever, 10.10.10.8.10, whatever the heck they are anymore, they are recognizably the same thing. The one evolved into the other. It's still folders, it's menus, it's just a colorful, bigger, much flashier slot machine-y version of this, essentially the same thing. But it's not that the old one, which is dear to my heart, was a choice to make it Zen. It was, this is the best we can do at the time.
Mm-hmm.
If the computing power existed in 1984 to launch a Macintosh with a big color screen that was Retina, it would have. So it's not that they said black and white is better. It's black and white was what we can do at the time. There were color, obviously. That was the advantage of the Apple II, which is why it sold the Mac for so long. But there's a gorgeousness to it. Like when you write a poem, free verse, like the old saying, is like playing tennis with the net down. It's the restrictions that make it more interesting, and it's when you have that challenge, and that's why people make mumblecore movies. That's why, like, whatever, like you give yourself a limitation and you can make something maybe a little more beautiful out of it. Now I go back and forth a lot on this. Like I kind of pine for these days of simpler OSs because I grew up using the older Mac. Like I leapt on the Mac right away. Sorry, Apple II people, but I did. And I loved it. And just right away, I said, that's the future. Love the menus. Love all the... I'm in. Super slow and, oh my goodness, all the limitations. But I adored it. However, I pine to go back to it. Like, often I think, if I could, I would just run maybe OS 7. Give me a bit of multi-finder, but, like, that's it. I would run that today. But then I actually use it, and I think, I can't use menus that won't stay open when I click them. Like, all these little refinements. It's not the color and the flashiness. I could actually do without that. I would kind of maybe like that, like a skin on a modern Mac that makes it look like an old one. But I need to click menus and have them stay down without me holding my mouse down. Mm-hmm. I need to be able to, like, drag and drop multiple things. I need to be able to preemptive multitasking. Like, these things I cannot do without. I am spoiled by modern tech. I need those in my current computer. But I long for the aesthetics. And I think that's the thing that resonated with me on this article. It's the focus on the aesthetics. But I think we'd be fooling ourselves to think we could go back to the actual tech on a daily basis. What thinks you?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's probably true. It is true that the kind of the look of it is the calming thing that somewhere in the article was kind of talking about. You know, you have only a few pixels to do this in. You have black, you have white. How can you sort of design these icons? How can you make a trash can? How can you make a little Mac or whatever? You know, how can you give the idea of zooming and things like that without actually having the computing power to redraw the window over and over again? So there's a sense in which it was like every pixel was refined. And that's one of the things that makes it kind of like calm and artful. You know, if now every pic, half the icons are like a photograph of a toaster or something like that. It's like, you know, not as much work went into those.
100%. Yep.
So
who was the designer of the icons? It was Susan
Kerr.
Susan Kerr. Like, yeah. her brilliance is what adds so much to this. Like, the figuring out how to do the trash can icon and like all these little things are, mm-hmm. are just so perfectly done. I think like not enough can ever be said by like how much she made the original Macs the beautiful things they were.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you're right about the zooming, like the idea that like nowadays Windows all zoom in and swirl and wave goodbye or whatever as they send all your info off to a Russian hacker. But back then it was just like you click the close button and they can't do all that. So instead the window suddenly becomes just like a dotted outline of just the rectangle, and then that closes down. Like, that's what they had the power to do. But that evokes the same idea that the window is closing and going back into its parent folder or going back into the hard drive. And so it's as effective in communicating. But I still, again, can't go back to menus. They don't stay there when I click them.
Yeah.
Like, that's a deal breaker. That alone is a deal breaker for me.
Well, you know what, though? There was a regression that I really hated at a certain point. And at this point, we're getting kind of in a like a Mac-specific world. But the title bars on Macs, there was a period of time, you know, I think it was later than System 7, it was maybe System 8 or something, where you could double-click on them and it would roll up.
Yes.
And so then we'd have just the title bar left. And I used that all the time. I loved that. You know, I would, you know, it was sort of crucial to my operating. And at a certain point, that just went away. There was something, I think it might have been at the transition to OS X. And for a while, there was like a little hack that you could get that I would always install that would continue this possibility. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of little interface tweaks that help. And actually, the other thing I was, you know, I'm watching this animated GIF go by. And I said GIF, and I will not apologize.
You hurt me. You hurt me, Paul. But, our topic should have been, let's discuss hard or soft G, go.
That's right.
3 hours later, everything would be resolved.
Right.
And finally, the conversation would, like, the internet would agree with me.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure that's exactly what would happen. what I'll do is I'll just, every time that we refer to this file format, I'll put in something that sounds either like Laurel or Yanny, right?
No, we need two different RSS feeds.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Just like, you just subscribe to the one and we'll do the show twice and we'll pronounce it one way or the other way. Or rather, I'll be on one of them and I won't be on the other show. But
yeah, perfect. Anyway, so this little animated movie thing that I'm watching, right?
Excellent.
And it loops. And it's basically the 9-inch screen. You know, so, and I was
the original like toaster Max, the
yeah,
right.
And, it even loses something when you go to the monster screens of the, you know, like the studio display on a cube or something like that, that like once it gets big enough, that's also distracting. You know, like I think the minimalist, you know, Zen aspect of this needs to be on that little screen.
And yet that's a screen size. I, as quickly as I could, went to 640 by 480. And then for a long time, that was my operating resolution. And mm-hmm. that's enough space with a old bitmapped display to give you decent room to see text on, like, say, a word processing app and still be able to see stuff on the side. Whereas the original Mac, the 512 by whatever it was, mm-hmm. that's a little too constrained for me. Like, for me, it really opened up at 640. And for the longest time, I was like, you know what? I can, 640 by 480 is good. 14-inch screen, 16-inch screen, whatever. 640, I could probably use that today. 640 by 480 is good. Because my eyes, like, we've gone to retina. And some people cannot. Once you go to retina screens, you can't go back. Mm-hmm. I'm old. I can't see a retina. They all look like retina to me. It's all, my eyes are too fuzzy. I'm like, whatever. I can't see pixels. I can barely see my hands. So I don't need retina things. Even the screen on my front right now, 27-inch monitor, lovely. It's not retina. If it was, or maybe it is, I don't know.
Right.
Without laser eye surgery, I can't tell. And which means if I get laser eye surgery, I now suddenly have to upgrade all my screens. Like, that just seems foolish.
Oh, yeah. I have two tangents I have queued up here. Here's the first of them.
This is all tangent.
Yeah. For a long time, I had in our sort of dining or like living room space, I had a big CRT TV that we would watch whatever TV we watched on. And, you know, so it's old, fuzzy CRT. It was a big screen. I forget how many inches, but, you know, like many inches big. But it was big, heavy CRT. And at some point, I live in a, you know, university town. So at the end of the academic year, there's tech all over the streets, right? You know, like people that people leave because they can't fly away with it.
Right.
So, and so now
that's a good tip, actually.
Yeah.
The university towns.
Yeah.
To like pick up discarded technology.
Yeah. Wait till the moving truck is gone. You know, so you know it's actually discarded.
Ideally, yes. Otherwise, it's breaking and entering. But
right. But so. I don't know what, like a year or something ago, we wound up with a big, you know, flat screen HD TV of a sort, but it's still like eight years old or something like that, you know, so it's not the new fancy kind, it's the old fancy kind. But the problem was that once I got, so we set that up, and once I got that, then like all of the digitized video that I had from before that looked fine on the CRT looked like just crap. You know, so I had to like re-encode everything.
See, because, that's my advantage. I have, in my little condo, my television is a 75-inch television because I'm a fool. And I sit like 8 feet from it, and I know it's way too close, but I like a really big TV. However, it's just a 1080p. Like, it's not even a 4K. It's a 1080p monitor on which I watch a lot of ripped DVD content.
Right.
So I'm watching things that are... I don't know, what's the resolution? 480p on, like, it's just blown up. And you know what? I can't tell because my old eyes, that's the advantage of getting old.
Yeah.
Just, the world is just lightly airbrushed and it's just lovely. And I don't have to invest.
Nice.
Well, okay, you were going to say you had two tangents.
Yeah.
So one was, went to a bigger screen, suddenly things look bad. That can happen on computer things too. What's tangent number two?
Well, the second tangent is, and this is actually also kind of TV related in a way, but cable boxes. I hate cable boxes. Cable boxes make me angry.
Yes.
And
that is the appropriate response.
Exactly. And one of the main thing that makes me angry about cable boxes is that they are little computers. You know, they have some sort of program and they draw graphical things. And it is almost 100% guaranteed that whatever processor they have in there, the UI code uses like 150% of what it's capable of. So you can never get, like, you can never have a grid, like a screen grid or whatever, that comes on quickly and you can scroll through, bip, bip, bip. It's always like draw, draw, draw. Press the button, draw, draw, draw. And it's like, you know, I know that if you just, I'm sure the processors are faster now. Just make a very simple code, put up very simple lines. Don't give me all the flashy stuff. Just give me the information as fast as I can hit the button. But they never do. And that, I mean, so that is also kind of like, that fits into the computer UI space as well. That like, if a modern computer did the computations that, you know, System 7 was doing, it would be a total delight to use.
Yes. Now, the thing is, how much of this idea that something like, for the two of us, an old black and white Mac operating system feels appealing, beautiful, and zen-like. How much of it is that because that's in the sweet spot of our personal histories? Like for me, I used the Apple II really early on, and I adore it, and it was mostly a consumption thing. I did a lot of gaming on it, and a little bit of programming, but not that much, in just like BASIC and Logo and stuff like that. And then I became a software developer on a Mac, and during a lot of my high school time, it was Macintosh, and I have, a real nostalgia for that. But is that just because of my age and my history, and so that's why it seems zen-like? Somebody else might say, no, what's zen-like is none of this flashy graphic stuff. Zen
right.
is Vax. Vax
right.
is zen, or zen is whatever, or old Atari things. I think maybe it's just zen is what you used in high school, and like adorable is what you used before high school, and like cluttered is what you used in university, and it just moves with your time.
Yep.
Because a lot of people will look back at the early iPhone OS and say, that was zen-like. I can't believe the new ones that we have that insert in the slot in our head, that they're all too fancy and full of ads. Don't you love it when technology used to be something that wasn't part of our bodies, but was a thing we held in our hands? And there'll be nostalgia for that. And they'll have wings and live in space or something. I don't know.
Right.
Kids today and their jazz and their space wings.
Yeah, could be.
So what stops you, though? If you love these things, what stops you right now? If you could have your SE30, I'm still jealous of you because you had one of those. I was an SE guy, but whatever. Fancy man with his SE30. So if you could have an SE30 on your desk today that was connected with a fast pipe to the internet, because that's a thing. You can't use it without that. And that you could get to everybody else. So you had a way to get on your current network. You could send files. You could receive files. And you could print on your current network. But your usable operating system would be that 9-inch Mac with a System 6 operating system. Could you do that?
Yeah, I don't know. I think probably realistically the kinds of things you could do on that, like I could conceivably write
like bitmap graphics for your fonts and stuff that wouldn't bug you, like the harder fonts. Like the day before font smoothing, like all these things, you're gonna lose all these little fuzzy text.
That's
things.
True. That's true. Like the the aggressively italicized letters.
Yeah, well, that's it. See, some fonts look okay. Like, I can go back to, like, a Monaco 9-point, and, you know, I could code in that now. Yeah. Like, that looks nice. Maybe I'm old, so Monaco 12. But, you know, basically just the font size gets bigger. But some of those fonts could look okay, but nothing italic. And I certainly couldn't, like, write all day in Chicago or one of those fonts. Like, oh, my gosh.
Right.
But some of them, some hold up, especially the little monospace ones.
Yeah, I mean, so I do spend a fair amount of the writing that I do in LaTeX, so that is kind of terminal based anyway. So I could probably handle that, but yeah, I guess it's true. I don't know. It would be an interesting experiment, but a lot, you know, a lot of the network stuff, I need to have Dropbox. I need to be able to open people's, you know, Word documents that are three times the size of like the entire maximum memory on this Mac.
Right.
But it seems like the main kind of application for this would be like writing, creative or otherwise, but sort of, you know, a sort of creative endeavor. I can't really imagine like reading email. Maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Actually, I can see it, but then again, it's like a text-based thing, but
yeah.
I don't know. I think it's more the like the little refinements. The, again, going back to that clicking menu.
Yeah. that really bugged me, didn't it?
Like, it really bugged me. Like, I was like, I forgot. That's one of those things where I take for granted now. And as soon as I start using it in emulation, I was like, oh, no. That's not acceptable. Yeah. Also, another thing that's always kind of bugged me, and maybe it only bugs me because I live here in the lovely city of Toronto. Mm. I don't know if you know this, but like the original Macs, they shipped with a bunch of fonts. People will know them, like Geneva and Chicago, a lot of cities, Athens, Cairo. There was Geneva, Chicago, Monaco, New York, San Francisco. There was Venice, that weird calligraphy font. New York, of course, which was like a Times New Roman thing, I think, because the New York Times, and then they couldn't license it, and then they got Times. And Toronto, which wasn't in like System 6, but the earliest ones, there was a Toronto font. And we got screwed. We got removed.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
It does sound...
So System 6 didn't have Toronto, but there was a Toronto font, which is like a big serif font that was like, I think it's called a slab serif, like the big thick serif fonts.
Huh.
And they took it out. So I'd want that too. I want clicky menus and I want the Toronto font.
Interesting. Yeah. I it sounds vaguely familiar, but I don't know.
How many people in Toronto would have noticed?
Yeah.
Well, let's nobody see. Else really cared.
Images for Toronto font Mac.
I got you interested.
I found it. Oh, there it is. Toronto 12 point.
It's not a particularly great font. I'm just saying it got removed.
Yeah.
It got removed probably for a reason because it's not a particularly useful font. But still, man, I shacked it.
There was a photo that I was sent, I guess, one of the very few photos that exist of my college years, you know, because photography was expensive and that sort of thing. But but it was a picture of me at the Mac, you know, this SE30 that you're jealous of. And on the wall, there was a printout, like a big elaborate printout of like all the fonts.
Oh,
so that was kind of cool. I located the document. I actually can't print it anymore because I couldn't manage to get this to come up and show all the fonts properly.
So quick question though, if you had to go back, we probably talked about this on an earlier thing, but just to wrap up, if you had to go back and use a vintage operating system for the rest of this year, and it can't be anything current, so it's got to be at least, say, 10 years old, what would you pick for an actual daily driver?
Probably. For real, so we'll assume that nothing Mac OS X is legitimate.
Right, yeah, it's got to be earlier than that.
And actually, honestly, like anything early Mac OS X is pretty horrible.
Well, honestly, I would pick OS 9 before most OS 10s.
Yes. Yeah, right. I mean, well, so if I'm allowed to, I would take OS 9.
Would it be a Mac thing? Would you stick with that?
Yeah. I think, yeah.
Because of familiarity?
Probably. So that would be about the same time as, I think, I don't even know, Windows, 95 or something?
Right.
I don't know. I would have to learn Windows 95. So that also means I can't make a totally fair comparison. But I think I could work with Mac OS.
It would
9.
Be a graphics one then. So you didn't immediately say, well, then I'm going to switch to Unix or something.
Oh yeah, no, I wouldn't.
Desktop Linux, it's getting good. Finally, apparently, every year. Sorry, Linux people.
Yeah. Well, but that's not retro, right?
Oh, that's true, right? You know what? It still is. It's just recently created.
Yeah.
I would do the same thing, and I feel like it's a cop-out. I feel like I immediately also would say, well, then I'd be picking like what version of the old Mac OS to use, because I don't think I use an Apple II as my daily driver. And anything else, I'd be learning it. Like, do I sit down? Do I pick an old Sinclair operating system? Then I'm going to be spending the first 3 months learning how to use Sinclair stuff. Yeah. Like, I've dabbled in other computers, but if you put me, say, now an Atari 800 is my daily driver, well, I'm going to every day love the aesthetics of the computer on my desk, because I would never get tired of looking at an 800. They are drop dead gorgeous. I love them. But I'm going to have fonts that are the size of my fist, like the big chunky things. Yeah. Every time I look at an Atari, I think, like, you don't have any words smaller than that? Like, what's with your text? And I don't know the operating system. So anything I picked that wasn't something I used in my personal history. So I suspect that my bias is the thing that makes me pick, oh, then I'm going to use like System 6 with MultiFinder just to be that guy. Yeah. But it's more because of personal history than an unbiased opinion of, oh, you know, you could use, because maybe like I could pick the next operating system and that would be a much better daily driver. But I only use that a little bit. So.
Yeah, that's a good choice. I think I'd still stick with Mac OS 9, but the next.
Plus I'd be a super hipster with my Mac OS 9 computer.
Yeah.
So I got that going for me.
I have a cube that I can just start. Like, it's just out in my office. I can just touch the top of it.
You've got everything I want. I don't even want a lot of stuff, but the stuff I do want, you got all of it.
Sorry.
I like the cube. I like the cube a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
I always like the cube.
And it's actually super fast.
Because it comes as like a 450 or a 500 megahertz. Megahertz? Gigahertz? megahertz. Okay.
But yeah, I don't know actually what the specs are, but it feels quick. I mean, like it's.
But again, that's the operating system. Try to run the modern OS on it and it'd be worse. Is it running 9 or is it running an OS X?
9 of some kind.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
See, that'd be a sweet computer.
Yeah.
I could use that.
Yeah, I think I would.
Just saying.
I think I could. Yeah. It's there almost ready to use, but
do it, Paul. Do it.
Yeah.
Be that guy.
One of the ones that's more out than the others. So.
You got your lazy summer days coming up.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually turned it on fairly recently to. Like I specifically sort of set it up and turned it on so that I could read the data off of an enhanced CD single that I had. It went back from the olden days when there was like also data on there, so I had like a little QuickTime thing.
I did one of those recently for a Tanya Donnelly CD, and I was like, hey, look, there's a video on this. I wonder what it is. And it's like a teeny tiny QuickTime movie. I was like, whoa, that is pixelated. I felt like it was like something like a cut scene out of Myst or something. I was like, look at this.
But it's cool because you can see it, you know, and the modern computer couldn't do anything with it.
Yeah.
So.
Take that, modern computer.
All right.
I like it.
All right,
I like our discussion.
Yep, that was
good.
We've
decided we're going to stick with modern computers. The RCR podcast take on this is modern computers are better with your daily driver.
Yep, I think that's probably.
Sorry, the other ones are Zen, but I don't think I can actually switch.
Yep.
Oh, well.
But it's still interesting to think about, and it's interesting to kind of remind ourselves about, like, you know, how under the constraints of the olden days, things were still accomplishable, you know?
Yep. And beautiful and had like a simplistic, beautiful beauty to them, because there are also fewer ads and pop-ups and like all the distractions. Like, there's so many things in modern computers that actually make me more efficient. And it comes with so many other things that are just distractions and annoyances.
Yep.
Such is the world.
All right. So, so for the last couple of times, we've been kind of not doing all that much of the listener feedback, and so it's been sort of piling up.
Mm-hmm.
And this time, it's been so long that I don't really remember what they all are.
You have to declare at some point feedback bankruptcy and move on, the way I deal with email multiple times a year.
Right, but I think I'll give it a shot, and I will apologize in advance if I have not quite. I will not apologize. Never mind.
No, screw those listeners.
Whatever. Okay. All right. So Eric on Facebook pointed us to a video of his ETPB that is attached to a MIDI board, which allows his TI-99/4A to send sound through a MIDI connected synthesizer. And there's this YouTube video about this. So you can watch this in like an 8-minute video of it kind of working. And I think I didn't entirely understand how this worked, but so the ETPEB is, so again, you know, to remind everybody and myself that the PEB is the peripheral expansion box that came with the, that you could get with the TI-99/4A, and that held all the, you know, expansion things. They're big, huge, you know, hilarious things. So the ET, PEB, I forget what ET is. Oh yeah, the E in ET is Eric, I think. Eric's tiny PEB, I think, is what this stands for.
Okay, cool. That makes sense.
But so it's a little
as
thing.
Opposed to tiny Eric's
PEB. Tiny Eric's tiny PEB. Right, PEB. But and so this is like a small thing that you sort of put in the side. The 99/4A had a like a side slot that you put in cartridges or attach sidecar peripherals to and things. And so, when, I see. There's actually a link here. I can follow the link to the discussion. Eric's tiny PEB. Yes, nice. Okay. So it's kind of a multifunction thing that you can stick on there. It seems to have a like a flash card on it, and actually looks like there's a little display and stuff. But so what's happened in this YouTube video is actually setting it up to do MIDI as well. So that was kind of like an extra thing. And I did watch this, but you know it was a while ago. But what I believe has happened here is that essentially it's somehow rerouting the normal sound output to go through MIDI, so that like existing games can send their sound through some sort of MIDI pathway, which is pretty wild. So you know you get like a very fancy sound out of this you know your TI-99/4A game.
Yeah, and that kind of thing, I think that's a great use for MIDI. I have been MIDI negative my whole life. Like every time I hear MIDI things and I'm like, wow, that doesn't sound good. Like it just like MIDI has always sounded awful to my untrained non-musical ear. Mm-hmm. But something like this, where we're going to say like take the bleeps and blips that would have come out of an existing game and route them over, it's clearly an upgrade.
Right.
So I'm super positive on this. Whereas generally MIDI sounds like, well, that's a terrible version. Like that would be in an elevator or something, like elevator music versions. Like, but early 80s elevator music version of like, instead of the real song, here's the MIDI version. I'm like, nobody wants that. But doing this kind of thing, I say thumbs up to this for Tiny Eric.
Yeah. Right. Yes. The, you know, at its core, you know, MIDI is like a instrument communication protocol, essentially. Right.
It says, hello, hey, synthesizer, do the following.
Right.
As far as I know, it's because it's offloading all that to music devices like synthesizers, drum machines, or whatever, and it says, hey, here's the signal, you go off and play it.
Right.
It just always sounds awful. I think that's a very controversial opinion, but it's...
Yeah.
It's always sounded awful to me.
Well, so, I mean, it's essentially just like the computer serves as a sequencer, and the awfulness is going to be in your, you know, your big fancy synthesizer.
Right. And I think that most of the MIDI music I've heard, frankly, hasn't been played through a synthesizer.
Right.
It's like you get a MIDI player on your computer and it does its best and says, here.
Right.
I'm like, no, yeah. Stop that, please.
Right. So the computer's serving both as sequencer and as instrument.
Well, like, so that's on me.
And I think the, you know, the Doom song and stuff like that, you know, that's all those things are like MIDI, like computer games will frequently use MIDI as the format in which they save their music. So I guess that one thing that means is that it makes it relatively easy to feed it into external instruments.
It's player thingies.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But, anyway, I dig it. So we're going to have a link to that. We'll have a link to the YouTube thing in the show notes. Awesome.
Yep. So, and
everybody else can check out the SPEB.
Right. Okay. And let's see. So Bakai wrote an email to alert us. There's something called, and I have no idea how to pronounce it, but I will say Phasic.
Yeah, I've been saying Phasic as well. And this is super cool. I totally played with this.
Yeah, I looked at it. But, well, actually, if you played with it, go ahead and describe it.
So it's a computer on the web. So it doesn't seem to be based on a particular computer. It's not like, oh, I've created an online version of Atari or whatever. It's its own computer as far as I know. And so it's like just a website that kind of pretends to be a computer, and it has a built-in BASIC, and online you can read all the BASIC commands. There's a bunch of them. The drawing commands are basically, there's dot, like make a dot here, make a dot there. So it's got text, and it's got a decent graphic screen, and you can make a bunch of colored dots, and you can play with things. You can save stuff. So you type a BASIC command, and then you can hit save, and you can come back to it later. So it's really, it's implemented a little 8-bit computer called the Phasic, as far as I know, just not exists elsewhere, and it's just on the web, and it's really neatly done. Like, I was very impressed with how slick it is, and one of the neat things is, when you're playing with it, it's not, it doesn't take over your whole, the whole web browser screen. It displays the computer monitor as if it's an old retro television. So it's big television set with dials on the side, and like, that's the monitor you're looking at. So it, it just uses as like a little graphic around the outside, but I like the touch. So I really dug it. It's really well done.
Yeah, it seems pretty cool. I wonder if I'll have time to play with it, but I mean, like, you know, because now we're learning a total new system. It's like Esperanto. Yeah, but... like, you know, it's nobody's native language. Everybody has to learn that. Anyway, yeah, but it's a neat thing that I had not come across prior to getting this feedback. So that's cool.
Me neither. And I thought it was really well done.
So Micah sent an email saying, just pointing out.
Same Micah?
No, the other one was Mackay.
Oh, okay.
So, uh-huh. And neither of them are Australian Michael.
Right. Okay.
At any rate, yeah. So, and I think, so what Micah wrote, he basically sent a YouTube link to a clip from a program in the UK called Database, I think. We might have had a link to this before, but it, even if we have, you know, go watch it again. It's pretty interesting. It's basically covering how to send email in 1984. So it's demonstrating connecting over the modem, and it's got a couple of people who sort of like have a computer share arrangement in their apartment where like the neighbors each put in money to buy the computer, and they dial into the show, and, you know, dialing in with a rotary phone and transmitting the, in fact, actually, I wonder if this might have been the show that ended with an actual transmission that you could record and play into your, you know, whatever it is, your BBC Micro or something. It might have been.
Well, technically you could do that with any program, but this one would like have functionality if you did it.
Right, right. But anyway, it's definitely worth watching if you haven't watched it.
I have not watched this, alas.
Okay, yeah.
So I will have to check it out, though. So it's from 1984, though, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, and you can, I think you can watch them type in their password.
Excellent.
And stuff, and the password
those still work.
Something like 1234. You know, it's great.
Some of those people are probably still using those passwords.
Yeah, excellent.
Just on new things. But that'd be really hilarious if they get hacked now, because somebody goes online and finds out that's all their current Gmail password.
Right, right.
Because if it was most of my relatives, it probably still would be. Oh my gosh! Don't you love being the tech support person in a family? It's great.
Yeah. 1234B. 1234C.
Totally, yes.
You have to change your
password. Then you go back to B. You only have the two, and you alternate between them. It's like, you're killing me.
Yeah. All right. Next one. Quinn wrote in over Twitter a little while ago, and actually, it's good that you're here. So
I thought so too.
All right. Well, yes. I mean, it's always good that you're here, but this is a particularly sort of Canadian thing. A couple times ago, we talked about this Bits and Bytes musical that was on the Antic podcast. There was an interview with the people who said who
and
did
it was
that.
Such a great interview. Yeah. Yeah, we linked to that one, and it was amazing.
And so what Quinn said was that the Bits and Bytes musical reminded her of the Canadian show Bits and Bytes, and I think that's actually come up sometime in the distant past on the podcast as well.
Probably. But I'd be the kind of person who would bring it up. TV Ontario made great stuff.
Yeah. So there's a YouTube channel full of them. And, you know, I haven't actually watched them. Even though we had this link, I'm sure, like 3 years ago or something like that, I never did go and follow up. But so what is it? I mean, is it
So TVO or TV Ontario is basically the like provincial funded television arm in a sense. So it was around as a kid. As far as I know, it's still around now. And a lot of the programming I watched as a child, any educational thing or whatever, think of it as like PBS for television. So I guess maybe PBS is for television, but okay, it's for PBS. but based on Ontario, so TVO. Although I think a lot of the stuff played across Canada, but TVO was just what made them. So TV Ontario, some of my favorite things ever were, as a child, were like Math Patrol, like these like silly 80s and 70s TV programs for kids. But there was this, one of the TV shows was Bits and Bytes. In fact, there were two versions of Bits and Bytes. There was Bits and Bytes starring Luba Goy. Oh, Luba Goy. She is like just one of the great Canadians of all time. Like, all of us must pause and enjoy the fact that Luba Goy was a thing. In fact, maybe still is a thing. I shouldn't talk about her in the past tense. I don't know if she's dead. You know, she probably is alive. Sorry, Luba. Anyway, a treasure of Canadianness. Just everything she touched is beautiful. So she was the host of the original Bits and Bytes. Came out, I think, in 1983, and was a TV show just to tell people about computers. And just like, you know, how do you use them? What do you do with them? What's that? Like basically a way to, it wasn't like trying to sell you on stuff. It was, let's talk about computers. Computers are a thing. How would they be used? How would they be used in industry? How are they going to be used in education? How do they work? Like what is a program? What's a floppy disk? What's the methodology? It was just amazing, amazing and wonderful. So that was the first program. And then in the very early 90s, something like 1990 or 1991, it came back. Bits and Bytes came back with Billy Van, another Canadian treasure. A lot of people might know him. There was a TV show called The Hilarious House of Frightenstein. And if you don't know it, I have introduced you to something glorious. And SCTV, Second City Television, would frequently make fun of it. So if you know Second City stuff, but you haven't seen Hilarious House of Frightenstein, it's going to seem weirdly familiar to you. The whole, like, it's in 3D, and they would say, that is Hilarious House of Frightenstein. So Billy Van was part of that, where he played a witch and stuff, and it was great. He was the host of the second version, and he was kind of like the instructor. And then there was like a student, and in the second one, Billy Van was teaching the student about computers, but at that time it was now like a DOS thing. So it was like, okay, same idea. What is a computer? How to use it? But it was kind of a little more modern in a sense. Like they updated it for the 90s. Mm-hmm. Honestly, they should have done it every 10 years. It's wonderful, wonderful stuff. So Bits and Bytes. I have strong and fond memories of it.
Yeah, I should watch these. So that's what I should do with my lazy days of summer.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
All right.
And Hilarious House of Frightenstein.
Yes.
I strongly recommend, and it holds up. It's weird. Like, so because it's from, I'm going to say 1972, something like that. Like, so imagine a low budget, early 70s, black and white TV show that was getting away with stuff and was monster based. So there's like Count Frightenstein and Igor, who was his incompetent assistant, and there was a Wolfman and the Grammar Slammer who would come on and correct grammatical errors. And there was Dr. Pet Vet who would bring on like real animals and talk about vet things, but then maybe get eaten or whatever. it was all very weird. And there was a mini count who was like a little tiny version. He was a clone of the Count Dracula, but it was like a tiny version of the Count Dracula. And there was the Maharishi, and it was all a little inappropriate and a little weird and kind of for kids, but also very strange. And anyway,
nice.
Pretty awesome stuff. Yep.
I will. Yes.
Starring Billy Van and many others, and Vincent Price. Vincent Price in it, who would have like a segment where he would read a weird poem. Anyway, good show.
Excellent. I have two things to watch in Lazy Days of Summer.
Yes, indeed. So there you go.
All right. Oh, and here's another thing to watch. Matt wrote over email to point out that Lazy Game Reviews did a review of the Avon Beauty Vision personal color computer that we talked about at some point in episode 162. Turns out that this is the actual one that we linked to in 162. So.
Oh, that's funny. Huh, cool.
Yep. So if you want to see details of it actually running, the eBay auction was won by the person who does Lazy Game Reviews.
Excellent. So, nice.
And that's enough. I think that's enough for the
I agree.
Listener feedback.
That was excellent feedback. Well done, yes. Paul.
Well,
and well done, readers.
Yes. And listeners. Also listeners.
Who may also read the show notes.
Yes.
I don't know.
All right. And so now we can move on to the completely distinct items of interest in news.
Very distinct.
You can start.
Okay. So I am a software developer, which means to me, hardware is weird magic. I don't understand hardware. It's just like there's chips and they think, I don't know. Like some people are able to do both. You get people like Quinn or whatever can like write software and also make hardware. But most people seem to be either like a hardware person or a software person. I'm a software person, so I'm kind of in awe of hardware people. Like I can sit down in front of a computer and type a bunch of stuff that looks like gibberish and then it makes a game or it makes a website. I can do that. I understand that.
Right.
I don't understand how people can say, I'm going to look at a chip Oh, I see how that works. I'm like, come on. So anyway, Ken Sheriff, who we've talked about before, has a really interesting blog. He does IC reverse engineering and other things. And he decided to reverse engineer a chip called the 76477, which was a sound effects chip, probably most famous for being used inside Space Invaders, the arcade machine. You've probably heard of it. Mm-hmm. Space Invaders, have you heard of it? So he's one of these people who can look at not even a schematic, like basically an X-ray photograph of a chip and then say, okay, there's a logic gate. Here's a noise filter. Like, come on. So I don't know that this isn't all made up. Like, it could be, but I took it as face value. And I think he's actually able to do what apparently he can do. And it's pretty exciting. So I know vaguely about these things. I understand what an integrated circuit is. I understand like TTL, like that kind of like wired up logic stuff. And that was used in a lot of old video games. We used to talk about this stuff with Mike a lot when we did the No Quarter podcast. Mm-hmm. But this chip isn't either of those. Instead of being like wired up TTL stuff, it's like its own thing. And it's just like, hey, let's do this and make a sound chip. And it's all very weird and very different than a typical IC, even of the period. And so it's a fascinating write-up. I didn't understand almost any of it. But
experience was fun to read.
Well, it's more that like the stuff that I know logic because I'm a developer. So I know what I know the basic idea of like a logic gate. Here's an AND gate. Here's an OR gate. And I get the concept that you can put a billion of those in a row and suddenly you've got, you know, Facebook. But this uses like gates, like a normal gate, like say you have an AND gate. So you got two inputs and one output. Mm-hmm. And if both inputs are yes, if they're both live, then the output is active. And if only one of them or neither of them are, then the output is not. So I understand that idea. Two ins, one out, that's an AND gate. This thing has gates that are one input, multiple outputs. So its AND gate is like one thing comes in and it goes out according, like it's like, but how is that? It's like backwards. All the stuff is backwards. It confused my mind, but it's fascinating. So if you're into integrated circuits, if you're into reverse engineering hardware, this is a really good, really detailed, very impressive, confusing write-up of hey, here's a zoomed in photo of a chunk of a chip and a bunch of arrows to say, look, here's the input. It would go along this wire, do this. Here's a weird 1-in-17 out NAND gate. And here's where the output comes in. Like, oh, really? Okay. I found the whole thing fascinating, confusing, a little intimidating. And I was really interested. So there you go. Never even heard of this chip before, but I've heard of Space Invaders.
Yep.
So I bring that to the table.
Yeah, no, it looks,
so there you go.
It's a little bit inspiring, you know, to read this, to think like, I could conceivably learn this, and it would be interesting if I did, you know.
But will you?
No, but I could.
But you could, but I could.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
We've talked about Ken Sheriff before. I'm positive.
Oh, sure.
I think I've been on this blog before, and I think I've been equally impressed and intimidated before. Seems to be what he does: impressive and intimidating things.
Yeah. I believe that it was his blog that had a write up of. It was like a, what do you call it? Like a fake chip.
Was that one? Yes. Yeah. It was something about it. And it was right. Okay. I remember that as well, that we did that on a much earlier show.
Mm. So it was supposed to be like a memory or RAM chip or something like that, but it was something else. And so the detective work was in trying to figure out like what was it, you know, and it turned out to be a touch tone generator or something.
Right.
But,
When I was reading through his blog site, and I don't have links for these, so unfortunately, but just to give you dear reader / listener / whoever you are, to give you another reason why you might want to follow the link you go over there on his blog, like he's got stuff like about Bitcoin mining, which I'm not that interested in, but he did some of it on an IBM 1401 punch card mainframe.
Yeah.
But to figure out how to do that, first he decided, let's learn how to do Bitcoin mining by hand. Mm-hmm. So he does it with graph paper, pencil and paper, goes through and is doing like, goes through all the process by hand and walks through, like, let's mine a Bitcoin and see. And it, and he can do, it's like one hash every 2 days.
Right.
It's like over the length of his lifetime, he might be lucky to get like a millionth of a bit. Anyway, it's pretty funny, but it's that kind of thing. It's like, let's get out and let's draw ones and zeros on graph paper and let's go mining Bitcoin with pencil and paper. Like, how cool is that?
Yeah.
He does that kind of thing. Again, impressive and intimidating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I definitely want to read through all of those blog posts at some point.
Yeah. So that's what I got. What do you got?
I got sad news. So Rick Dickinson, who is the industrial designer of the Sinclair home computers, passed away a little while ago now. All of like the ZX Spectrum and I think the ZX81, you know, these were his designs. And one of the things that is interesting, I mean, about this, apart from just the sadness that you know, he made iconic computers at and is no longer with us, but before he passed away, he had started posting some of the some of his prototype designs to a Flickr gallery. So there's a Flickr album that has like a model of the ZX82 mock-up and stuff. And a lot of these are not functional things. They're just like, you know, this is what it would have looked like and, you know, what would it have taken. So this looks a little bit, it's kind of like a cross between a Spectrum and a ZX81. But they're actually like he posted them, you know, he was posting it and describing stuff about it. And so I think that's kind of neat that he made these things available. So it's worth kind of looking through those and, you know, just sort of seeing what could have been and just being impressed with the accomplishments that were. I don't know if you had any experience with Rick Dickinson or Sinclair computers.
I have experience in that I owned, as a kid, a Sinclair ZX80, which apparently was sold in Canada. Like, I know it as a UK computer, but it didn't get imported from the UK, and it wasn't like a PAL computer. And it was the one with the... They all had like really flat, crappy keyboards, right. But it was the one that was like super flat, like a membrane keyboard that wasn't raised at all. So you got like a white box with a white lump on the top of it, and then sticking out front really flat was the keyboard. Completely awful computer, like just terrible. Like from the moment I had it, but it was one of my earliest computers, like before an Apple II. Before this, I had an Altair 8800. Which was also, let's face it, a pretty useless computer. Like, it had little switches in the front, and I was like, oh my God, I had this dream of like a real computer is what I wanted. And so the first few I went through before the Apple II was really my first, I guess maybe actually I had a Model 1 first. That was the real first computer, but the Apple II was the one I fell in love with first. But in those super, super early days, I had a ZX80 that my dad brought home. I think he had done some work for somebody or whatever, and I think he got it as part of like one of those things. My dad was in sales, so he did a lot of things like in trade. Hey, we'll put out these coupons, you give me a computer. We had a lot of that as a kid. So I think that's how I ended up with a Sinclair ZX80 and I used it for a little tiny bit, but didn't really do much with it. And I kind of hated it from right away, but you don't want to say that to a parent who gives you a computer and you're like, well, that's awful. Yeah. I didn't want to be that guy. So that's my memory, unfortunately. I apologize to Rick Dickinson for just like slagging off his computer, but that's the only, I always wanted a ZX Spectrum, but I didn't ever had one. Mm-hmm. So I just had a ZX80, unfortunately.
Well, I think, I mean, so one of the things about these designs is it is quite a bit like the thing we were talking about you know, Susan Cares icons and stuff like that I mean, the constraint was you have to have a membrane keyboard because you can't afford keys, you know, so like, right. what can you do, how can you make this, what is the best you can do and still,
which going to sell for like 80 pounds or whatever, like, right. Like it was probably a computer that sold for like $125 in Canada or something like that. So what kind of computer can you make for under $150 retail price after packaging, after shipping, after whatever? That's a pretty big constraint. But the idea there of like computers for the masses, as the Atari people would say, or was that Commodore? I don't know. One of the other brands.
Yeah.
All the, for the masses, not the classless masses or whatever it was. So that's a laudable idea though. Like, it's like that one laptop per child thing, right. That just kind of went away. Whatever happened to that? So I laud the effort, and I think it's an important thing to have computers available for everybody, but it also resulted in not a great computer.
Yeah, although I still think, I mean, you know, at least maybe it's just a kind of nostalgia, even though I never actually had one of these in the past, but they are sort of iconic little designs. I mean, like the ZX81 is kind of, it's kind of pleasing looking, even if it isn't pleasing to type on.
I think the 81 looks a lot nicer than the 80. I think that was a major upgrade aesthetically.
The 80 has it reminds me somehow of like a shoe or something like that. I don't know, or something. There's
a flipper. It looks like a flipper. Because it's so flat. Like, because there were two ZX80 models. I've seen ZX80s that don't look anything like the one that I owned, that are thicker on the keyboard part. Mm. But the one I had is like, it looked like you could bend the keyboard. It was literally just a flat flap that came out in front.
Yeah.
And that's all it was. And so that's the ZX80 that I had. And yeah, Z, baby.
Yeah. Right, right. And the Spectrum actually had, you know, like actual little pushable keys, though nobody liked those either. But again, you know, right. Like they had to do what they could. So, because they couldn't afford a keyboard. So they had to sort of like try to do something.
I think people don't realize also when you look at a photo of a ZX80, you don't realize like how tiny it is too.
Right.
Like if you spread your hand wide, your pinky finger and thumb would be wider apart than this computer. Like it's a teeny tiny little thing.
Oh yeah.
So the idea that it's like we're okay going to scrunch down, like even for metal, like it's very small. It's basically a portable computer that wasn't portable.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I took a photo at one point of a ZX81 next to my iPhone, you know, and they're like equally tall.
Yeah.
You know, whereas I guess it's deep for the ZX81.
Yeah, because photos of it often don't show it in like context.
Yeah.
They'll show it in front of a teeny tiny little television monitor, like a little 9-inch monitor. It makes it look larger because you're thinking modern TVs. But what you got to do is see a photo of somebody trying to type on one and you realize, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like, you couldn't really get both hands over that keyboard.
No.
But anyway, it's a bummer that he's dead, and it's amazing that he was uploading that stuff, though.
Right, yeah.
And I did see the picture of, like, the future... There was, like, a future ZX Spectrum idea that was all glossy, and it looked really cool. Like, so it was neat that he was still thinking about that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm really glad that these were made available. I mean, you know, because they could have easily not been made available, but he did that himself, so...
Yeah, well done him.
Then the other note I had stuck in there, I don't know if this is a concern. It's always a concern, but... apparently Smug Mug. Did you know Smug Mug? I didn't really know them before.
I heard of them, and I only know that like they're the company that just bought Flickr, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is...
Flickr should have been Instagram. Flickr's a company that said, I don't feel like being Instagram. Why don't you go be that bigger thing?
Yeah.
What was Flickr thinking?
Yeah, I don't know, but...
Is it because Instagram had an I and Flickr was like, okay, but we've already got a vowel. We can't have more than one.
Right.
Oh, it's weird. This is from that period where it was like, of course it's spelled F-L-I-C-K-R. Of course it is.
Yeah. Although Quinn, I forget now in what context, but she did on Twitter at some point, she observed that this is largely like search engine optimization now. You know, like you pick something that's not going to match with just any word so that people can find you. Right.
Oh, actually, that's a smart play, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like eBay, like whatever. It's and I think which is actually named after something Bay, like a place. But still, the idea is, yeah, we'll call it Amazon, we'll call it eBay, we'll call it whatever.
Yeah, but so you know, you remove the vowel from. You don't want just anything that contains the word Flickr in it, so you remove the E.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So I know there are a lot of things though that we have linked to in the past that. Resided on Flickr, and there's always this sort of like precariousness of that, you know, that you never really know. If Flickr seemed huge, it seemed unlikely that it would ever go away, but now
too
it's been acquired.
Too big to fail.
And
right.
Who knows what Smug Mug will do. You know, the fact that I barely had heard of Smug Mug before makes me a little concerned that maybe it's all going to go.
Right. I think it's a little family business,
but,
if I remember from the news. It was a family business. Mm. Which doesn't mean it's little.
Yeah.
It could be a massive family business.
Right. Well, Flickr must have been huge. I mean, like, that can't have been cheap to acquire. But
well, yeah, but I don't know if it's... Maybe it's just been bleeding money for the last 5 years.
Yeah.
Like, somebody took over the bleeding debt that is Flickr. Like maybe you and I could have bought it. Oh, maybe we should have.
Yeah. Like, only retro computing pictures can remain.
Exactly.
But...
Or it would insert a retro computer into your photo.
Yes, perfect. But anyway, yeah, so I'm a little worried that things like, for example, these Spectrum prototype photos, you know, that's where they exist, right? So who knows? Maybe all this will go to the Internet Archive at some point, and I'm sure they are aware that this has happened. So
right.
Okay, let's move on from that to new games.
New games. So new games are coming out, and not for the platform I use, although new games do come out for the Apple II quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to celebrate some new, pretty unbelievably high quality games have been coming out recently for both Atari computers and ZX Spectrum. And these are all very recent releases. So the first is a version of Time Pilot has just been released for the Atari XL / XE. And it is crazy good looking. Like, it is just, oh, so it's the arcade. I mean, it doesn't quite have the colors of like an actual arcade version, but you look at the videos of this playing and it is remarkably polished. It's just bonkers that this exists. It's one of those examples of like, wow, so this could have been done back in the day, I guess. And this it's crazily good. So if you have access to an Atari and any interest in arcade games, it's definitely one to go catch up. It's available for free now and will be available as a paid cartridge. So right now you can just download the game and play it, and soon there will be a cart you can get. Speaking of which, there is also a game called Helicommander, which is also pretty slick with neat parallax background stuff. And it's kind of, it reminded me of a Choplifter kind of game. So you're a helicopter, you're going to shoot other things in the sky. It's a side-scrolling action shooter thing. Also remarkably well done and available both as a download, and you can order it as a cartridge available today. I think it's something like $40. So two really good Atari games have just been released, and two really good games have just been released for the ZX Spectrum. One called Nixie, N-I-X-Y, yeah, that's how it's spelled, is a platformer that is beautiful. Now, the Spectrum has those, like, welcome to the world of cyan colors, yeah, right? Like, they're just, like, in your face. It's very suitable for this kind of thing. Like, it's Nixie is this, like a magical sprite that's looking for the Gaia Stone or something. And so the colors are really fitting for this game. So it's a platformer game. And I think even without, like, if this was on another platform, these colors would match up perfectly. So it's not just like, oh, we had to use these. It's great. It's a magical pixie fairy platformer. Of course it would be these kind of colors, and it's really polished, really nice looking, and I'm quite jealous because I don't have a Spectrum and I would play the heck out of this game. So available today. I think it's been reviewed on a couple of big sites as well, but we'll have a link over to the Bubblesoft games. That's where I heard about it first. Really nice, available again, free download right now. And a cool looking game, maybe a little less polished, but caught my eye first for the ZX Spectrum. I think it's pronounced Qua Happy. It's Q-U-A Happy. So Q-U-A-H-A-P-P-Y. And it's basically you play this little guy, Andy Dauntless or Dauntless Andy or whatever. And so, because you're not afraid to go into scary places, you kind of go into a house, bouncing around, looking for keys. And it's like just a bounce around level game. More in keeping with what you would think the Spectrum would look like. Like, it's a whole bunch of heads, and here's a yellow head, and here's a purple head, and that's the characters. And so it's kind of more what I think of as a Spectrum game, but it's what I think of as a Spectrum game. And you got to pick up these little coins and going through like a maze. And I thought it was quite well done. So I saw that too, and I thought definitely one, if I had a Spectrum, I would be downloading. So that's four very polished games for two computers, or two different computer platforms. And then also we'll throw out slightly less polished, more of a stripped down game, but interesting. A version of Minesweep has just been released for the VIC-20. The poor VIC-20 that never seems to get any love on this show. It never gets mentioned, but I'm going to throw it out. So it's called Minesweep Mini. So it's like a mini version of Minesweeper, available now for the VIC-20. So the VIC-20 has a new game too, totally free, available. So if the VIC-20 is, for whatever reason, your vintage platform of choice, you got yourself a game too. You also get a little green and white mono game. You get Minesweeper. That's what you get. So there you go. But anyway, lots of new games coming out. I love modern game development for vintage computers. I love that new stuff is coming out all the time. So five new games for three old platforms.
Yeah, those are really cool. And it is sort of weird to think about the possibility, like with Time Pilot, that this could have been released in 1984 or whenever this was.
Both the Nixie game and the Time Pilot game are kind of shockingly good. They're kind of like, you look at them and go, oh my goodness. Like,
yeah.
These could have come out at the time. The Time Pilot especially. It is so smooth and there's so many sprites on screen. And it is Time Pilot, and which is an arcade game I really, really like.
Yeah.
And so I looked at this and I was like, oh, other than being slightly lower resolution, I think maybe not even that. It's more that the colors are a little muted because they're the Atari colors versus the arcade colors. Mm-hmm. But it's really polished. It's shockingly good.
Yeah, I think I will definitely try to play that. That was one of the ones that it just went straight to in arcades.
It's still a go-to arcade game for me. It's and this is really good.
Yeah.
So if you have an Atari, there's no reason not to be getting this. In fact, I would probably be buying a cart when they become available.
Yeah.
Because I like it. It looks that good.
Very nice. Cool.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I wonder why. I mean, I guess that we have some computer science advances that we've made now. And I'm just sort of wondering why things like this didn't exist. and why we can
also
do them
now. I also
think
development environments. Like, yeah. You get these cross-compilers and stuff, and I've now knocked out a couple of small things for the Apple II that I never would have done otherwise, because I can write them in C or write them in something more modern and compile it out, and you can iterate through things faster, and then you just also get to steal ideas from other things. But I don't know why it is the case that somebody can then take an old game, like Time Pilot, that existed back then, and it just, you know, is just a better coder, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know, it's just remarkably good.
All right, so I guess we'll move on to the last one I was going to mention, which is that there is a large auction that is going to be happening at the end of this month as we record. So if I get this out quickly enough, it'll be just happening probably as you're listening to this. But so on May 31st at the New Jersey Convention and Exposition Center in I don't know where, somewhere in New Jersey.
In New Jersey.
Yeah, it's one of the exits, right? Isn't that the way you talk about New Jersey? So this is, and I'm not 100% sure I'm going to get the pronunciation right, but Bill Legitis, who has, he's written books about history of video games and that sort of stuff, and he has a huge, you know, super complete collection of all kinds of stuff. And he's, I'm not sure what the rationale is for downsizing, but he is downsizing. And so this is basically so one thing that's nice about this is it's like the estate sale of a collector, except that the collector is there, you know, alive, telling you about what these things are and sifting mm-hmm. through all this stuff. And yeah, so, but there is some amazing stuff in there. So, there's a article on Kotaku. This, I think it's been written up in various places, and you know, it's a big deal auction because this is some pretty fancy stuff. But so I will at least link to the Kotaku article about the auction, which
right.
sort of talks
and
about
some of these photos in there, so you can see like how much stuff it is. Like, it's just, we were talking about it before we started recording, that it's just like a dragon's hoard of stuff. Mm-hmm. But it's the way all collections eventually get. It's like piles and piles and piles of like just shelf after shelf of just piles of things. Mm-hmm. Unlike like a museum, we were saying, has a lot less stuff, but it's kind of displayed in an attractive way. Like here, everything's given a bit of space and have a little plaque in front and what have you. So that's how museums go. Whereas a home collection is generally just like, here are the shelves. I'm stuffing in everything as far as I can go. Stuff.
Yeah.
There's a quote in the Kotaku, there's a quote in this, which might end up being our host topic next time. I don't know, because it really resonated with me and it's probably going to resonate with you. And it's with him saying, because he's been collecting this stuff. Bill's been collecting this stuff, it says, since he was 7 years old. And he says, but it finally, it got critical mass. So it became a more of a burden than a blessing. It says, I went from an active user to an active storer. That was never my intention. Once you pass a critical mass of stuff, it's just too much stuff and you end up being able to use very little of it. So you have more, but you use less. It's like your hobby becomes a collecting hobby instead of a using hobby.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting. Oh, he didn't say, that last part is just the stuff I was adding. Yeah. He was just about the critical mass. But it's interesting, and I think that happens to a lot of people, where it becomes more about like getting it, but you never have time to actually use any of it because you're just getting so, and then you got to store it and clean it and whatever. And it can be your hobby can become a burden.
Yep. Yep.
But you look at some of these photos. And I'm like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Like, there's like everything here. It's crazy.
Yeah. It's not like he has 15 of everything that he needs to pare down. You know, I think it's already relatively well curated, but it was just big and
I think he's got one of literally everything.
Yeah. Although I can see two of something on some of these shelves. So. but
I mean, probably because he would forget. But it's everything from like modern vintage things. Like I see like an Atari Flashback 2, mm-hmm. which is a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, I see two of those. But also like old games and games in like boxes, but also lots of games in baggies, like, and just like so many things. It's just remarkable for lots of different platforms.
So as I understand it, at least the photos on Kotaku, they're kind of like the way things were at the point when the article was written, but he's been sorting stuff and setting it up for the purpose of this auction. So it's not going to be quite this big jumble at the auction itself. And this sounds to me like, I mean, New Jersey Convention and Exposition Center, that sounds like a big place to me. I'm not certain that this auction is the only event that's happening on May 31st at that point. It may be, you know, that this is several lots in a larger auction. I'm not quite sure. But
I wonder if this is going to come up more and more, though, as people downsize or die off or whatever.
Yeah.
Because there's going to be a lot more of these massive collections that kind of just get released back into the public.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. And I mean, and there will be a point, like right now, some of the stuff looks interesting to me, although I think I sort of feel like I would want to trade out things, you know.
Right.
But at some point there's going to be everybody's going to be dumping them and nobody's going to be picking them up because they're already in the process of dumping their
own.
That's
when I'll strike.
Well, yeah, hopefully somebody wants things at that point.
Yeah.
But
yeah. Because like he's got a bunch of games for the Apple II. It looks like still in their baggies. But he's got like Rusky Duck, which sells for quite a bit on eBay and such. But eventually everybody who wants Rusky Duck is going to have Rusky Duck.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
And the Rusky Duck market
will just collapse. Dumble. Yeah.
Right. But it says here he's got like a lot of things for like all the usual computers, the Apple II and such, but also a bunch of software for like the Tano Dragon. I'm like, what the heck is the Tano Dragon? Like so a lot of obscure things too. So this would be a really interesting auction to go look at, I think, or browse through.
Yeah. And it is not online. It's, you know, you physically go look at the stuff. So you have to be able to get yourself there. But
it's New Jersey. I mean, I could go there. Yeah. You could go. You could easily go there.
I could.
You should go there. You should buy all that stuff. Put it all in your office.
Anyway, so take a look at it. If there's a chance you can go, definitely be aware of it. And if it was yesterday, because I released this so late, sorry.
So what is the date of the auction again? Remind me.
May 31st.
May 31st. So end of May. Yeah. So coming up, 11 days from the day we're recording.
Yep.
You can do it, Paul. You can do it.
Yeah. All right. We'll see. Okay, and I guess, let's see, the only other thing I will mention here in this kind of section is that, so as we are recording, VCF East is happening, or maybe winding down, so hopefully that has gone well, and we were told by Micah over email that VCF Midwest is going to be happening again sometime in September 2018, so
cool.
That's all the details we know, but...
Oh, but that's good.
We're getting there, so...
I've yet to go to a VCF, and I think that is to my detriment. I think I would like it. I should head. I got VCF East is the one I should have gone to, and that's happening now. So
right,
but maybe the next.
But
one.
Both of us are delinquents and not going to that.
Exactly. Yeah. There's actually a different one. We've been talking a bit about. I'm more and more. I'm starting to get mentally back into Tandy stuff. Like I had the Model 1. I've always been a fan of Tandy. We talked about the Tandy, you know, hey, it looks like metal, feels like air.
Right.
But I've always had a soft spot for it because the Coco and the Model 1 that I had earlier. And more I keep thinking like I should, like there's that Tandy assembly coming up in October. And I should go to that. Make a trip. It's only in Ohio. It'd be an easy drive. I've been to Ohio to see other retro things. I should put it on my calendar just to at least consider it.
Done.
There you go. In fact, I just put it on my calendar to at least consider it.
Cool. And then, of course, Kansas Fest, and we'll be talking about that for pretty much...
Already signed up. Can't wait. Yep.
Oh, I now have my tickets. So we talk about this so much. But I forget actually what day it's supposed to start. I think it starts on Wednesday. But people start coming on Tuesday.
Right. And really Monday now.
Right. This year and last year, they opened up an extra super early day where you can come like the day before,
right.
And stay in the dorm. And so I'm signed up. I have my plane tickets and everything's all set to get there the day before.
That's my plan too.
Yep.
I think I'm going to be. There's a good chance I have. I don't know. It's a whole big thing. Not a big thing. I'm really excited about it. Like so, I've got a room at Kansas Fest. Like in the dorm, like that's where I always stay. But this year I'm actually going to be staying off campus. I'm trying something different, but I still have my single room there. So I can do a door thing. That's weird. I basically have two places to stay at Kansas Fest this year.
Cool.
Yeah. I'm doubling down on Kansas Fest because I'm so looking forward to it already.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And maybe in that context, it is not perfectly fitting to mention that like last year, this year is space limited. So,
right, so I'm just using up two of them. I'm only taking one spot. But
yeah, I guess that's true. Although I think the spots, well, anyway.
They're kind of limited by the rooms, so yes, yeah. I see what you're saying there. I probably should do something about that.
At any rate, last year it actually did fill up. This year they've added some extra spots, so it's not, it'll take longer before it fills up in principle. But I think it's 120, something like that.
Right, but still, limit. They're like hitting 100 already, and it's only May, so.
Yep. All right, so we can now leave that and go to the word from our sponsor.
You are about to witness Sir Clive Sinclair's quantum leap. He's come up with a computer to rival these machines at a fraction of their cost. The Sinclair QL system. With a massive 128K memory, color monitor, and four professional software packages, £698. Phone 200-0200 for your nearest stockist.
Fidelity Electronics introduces the first chess game that not only thinks, but also speaks to you.
I am Fidelity Chess Challenger, your computer opponent. Enter your move 3-1-C3. Enter. H4 to F2, Queen takes on check and mate.
Fidelity's Challenger Series games that find stores everywhere.
And we're back. All right, so I have now the responsibility of giving you the host's retro computing gift idea. And the gift idea for this time is a knit heart floppy disk made of 100% Peruvian Highland wool. It is a available on Etsy. It is $20. You can choose a color, which is either black and green or gray and light green. And they look pretty cool. I don't know what they're used for. I think they're used just to look cool.
That is enough of a reason.
Yeah.
It was good enough for me. It's good enough for things.
Yeah, right. But okay, so yeah, it's basically, it's sort of the shape of a little floppy disk. It's made of wool. And they're really cool looking. So this is the kind of thing you could give as a gift, I think, pretty easily, or just get for yourself for your desk.
And I think you'll be able to buy these at Kansas Fest. Cause
it is quite likely,
I think
we're
pretty sure that this is by Melissa Barron, who is a frequent visitor to, and displayer at Kansas Fest, who does lots of glitch art. I have bought one of her little glitch art things before, and I love it. I absolutely adore it. And she's got paintings and does like knitting. She's got like a loom, I think, or something. So she does knitting, and she frequently has a table at Kansas Fest during the thing at the end where you can buy
the
stuff.
The vendor fair, yeah.
Yeah, a vendor fair. That's it. So I suspect that these will be available, to keep on topic, at the vendor fair. Or maybe they will sell out since they're handmade goodies, and so you can pick them up now. For me, in Canadian dollars, it's $26.39. What say you in U.S. dollars? What would it cost you to get one of these things?
Well, it would cost me $20.
Ah.
So I guess that's probably the exchange rate at
100% Peruvian wool sounds like fine Peruvian, fine Corinthian leather, fine Peruvian wool.
Yeah.
Wonder if it's an actual thing.
So these are, they're made to order, right? Okay, because I was actually looking at the thing that says, don't wait, there's only one of these available, and I didn't realize that, because usually I don't, I try to have things that could last the gift idea, But I believe that they can be made to order. And if not, just admire them. They are cool, and go buy something else from her store.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Melissa is good people, and she makes really cool stuff.
Yep. All right. Let's see. So now I guess we can move on to the eBay auctions. And Carrington, we can start with yours.
Let's start with mine. I have picked something that I know very little about that may be a screaming amazing deal. Or maybe just like, why would you pick that? Because I don't know about this topic at all. So, but I've been trying to think, like, how can I pick something that's a different sort of computer? So I started thinking about like chess computers a couple of shows ago. And so finally found one that I want to recommend that I've picked. It's a Fidelity Electronics Chess Challenger. It's very expensive. It's a buy it now for $680. And it actually comes with both a chess challenger and a checkers challenger. And why I picked this one is I did a little bit of research into home chess computers. And this is the first one. Now, there were many of these. There's lots of chess challengers. There were at least 10 different models of this, like the Chess Challenger 7 and 10. And that's, you know, you can tell there's 10 of them because they were numbered. And there was also like the Active Voice chess challenger, like tons of them. But there's one particular one that is the one from 1977 that was the first one by Fidelity Electronics, and it's the first one that was available. So like, this is literally the first chess computer you could have purchased from 1977. And it doesn't seem to come up much in this particular model. And the way I learned that you can tell it, although maybe I'm wrong, but as far as I know, all the chess challengers have these little buttons on the side. And it's a row of four buttons by four columns of four rows. But the original one that was only out at the very first one, late 1977, four columns, three rows. And it's like the fancy one. Oh my goodness. Or maybe it's the worst one because it's first. And generally these things are not super collectible, but often in a line of computers, it's that very first one. It's the Apple One. It's not because it's better. It's because it's first. I suspect that makes this a lot more collectible. I've seen a bunch of these come up when I started looking at older auctions, and they're all like not working or for parts, whatever. This is an actual functional one, and you get the original first chess challenger and also the checkers challenger. I'm looking at those because, frankly, I'm not even that interested in this topic. But if you're interested in vintage chess computers, this might be a chance to pick up maybe a very collectible one. Maybe it's only worth like $400, and this is an overpriced auction because most of these things go very cheap. I don't know. Or maybe somebody's listing is going to go, oh my gosh, you can get one for less than 10 grand? Yeah, well, right now you can for a maybe bargain, maybe outrageous price of $680 US plus a little bit of shipping. Get an original working first 1977 chess challenger, and also they throw in a checkers challenger. So there you go.
Yeah, it looks kind of cool. I wonder, is this one of those ones where the pieces are dragged around by magnets, or is it
you move them. It'll tell you on the display, okay, now my move is to move from this to that, and then when you plop it down, I guess it knows where it is. Or maybe it's just you're supposed to don't miss a move. Maybe it doesn't even have sensors. It just plays chess. We'll also link to a couple of other ones. I read Mastering the Game, A History of Computer Chess, to look into like there were chess computers and computerized chess before these home ones, like way back in the 1940s and stuff. There were computers and the idea of, hey, can we make a computer play chess? And then really it got into the 80s, they became quite popular, and hash tables, and they got a lot better, they got really good, and there's like these Kasparov models and all such. But it was in 1977 was the first time you could go into a store and buy your own chess computer, and that was this Chess Challenger 1, the first one, and it was called the 1 because it only had like a single playing level, and later ones had more ways to play and whatever. And then I think very quickly the Chess Challenger 3 came out, which was like the second model, but it's called a 3 because it had three different levels. But the first commercially available chess computer was the March 1977 original Chess Challenger, which is what appears to be this one, I think. Or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's not even that one. Anyway, it's interesting to read about chess.
Yeah.
So we'll have a link to the Mastering the Game, History of Computer Chess, and also a link to an online thing called the Overtom Chess Computer Museum, that is a big collection of chess, like home chess games and computerized ones. And they also have one of these in the collection, like the oldest one, the Chess Challenger one. So they have one already. They don't need this one. This one can be for you, dear listener.
Nice.
Yeah.
I also seem to remember there was some kind of like film or documentary or something like that. So I looked up computer chess film, and there is a movie called this computer chess.
Yep, yeah. I saw it. In fact, I have it on DVD.
Is it good?
It is okay. I liked it, but I didn't love it. My memory of it is vague. It's in black and white, but that wasn't like an affect. It's a more modern movie. It just shot in black and white. Mm-hmm. Not an affectation, just a choice.
Okay, I have nothing more to say on that. But no, well, there looks you go. Cool.
So what you got? That was my one choice.
I have many things.
Excellent.
But and
one, two, three, four.
Perhaps
many.
Edit as we go. But so the first one I have is an MSI 8080 microcomputer, fully loaded with dual drive. It says, and it has a picture of it, sort of extra saturated, for some reason. So it's like very deep blue. But I assume that's just in the photograph. And there's two pictures. There's a picture of the front. Looks like all the switches are there. And then
yeah, what is with that blue? It's almost purple. That is not the color of these things.
Yeah.
But okay. You know, it looks like it's actually heavily filtered looking at this. This looks like an Instagram kind of photo. Okay.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure I assume that's what's happened. And it's sitting atop a dual disk drive unit. And then they've opened up the case and shown a pretty, shallow angle, view of the cards that are inside of it. So you can barely tell what's in there, but you can tell that there are, you know, like seven of them or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. That's
but you can't do your trick of looking and saying, oh, that's the really rare card that they don't know is in there, and then you buy it.
Yeah, if you're really adept, you could conceivably do this. Oh, actually, wait.
Pulling a Hagstrom.
Yes, we'll call it that.
Excellent.
The list actually, and going down to the description, it says what the boards are. So there's a CPU card, two RAM cards, interfacer 2, I don't know what that is, 3 PAR, 1 SER board. Oh, parallel serial, okay. Disk card, another parallel card, a CompuPro system support card.
Well, if they're parallel, you got to have 2 of them.
Right, of course, right. Synth Talker speech board. So this is getting quite close to what you need to recreate the War Games scene.
This is true, yes.
And the Prom Blaster.
If you're going to have one of these, that's what you have to do, right?
Like, I think
there's not much reason to have one of these other than to do War Game stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, but it looks pretty cool. I mean, like, except for the fact that the disc unit is basically white rather than black.
Which really is weird. What's up with that?
Yeah,
I think it looks... I don't like the look of that.
Yeah, they're not great-looking drives, but, I mean, they're drives.
Yeah.
This is a buy-it-now for $37.50. It doesn't say anything except, last tested the computer and drives were working fine. You know, so what does that mean? 1978, they worked or whatever.
Isn't that kind of expensive even for a... I guess it's fully populated.
Yeah.
But that's a little pricey, isn't it? I think I normally see them run at mid-2000s, don't they?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I
don't really shop for these things, so I could be wrong.
That seems about right to me, except this has a bunch of cards in it, and the drives make a big difference. I mean, they're probably as hard to find as the computer. Everything looks like it's in good shape. But the other thing that makes me hesitate, and the shipping is covered in this as well.
Oh, that's good. So, okay, because they're chunky.
Yeah, but I'm hesitant about this because it is a 2 feedback seller. So this is like somebody brand new to eBay. You don't know if they know how to ship.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of things that we talked about last time, and so. I don't know. I mean, like, it actually, if you were really looking for one of these, this might not be such a bad one, but it's kind of a gamble. I think you'd probably really want to talk to them about it. But who knows? It might actually have already sold by the time this even gets edited, because it is a buy it now. So, and it's not in the stratosphere, this price. It's the kind of thing where you could imagine, like, if you had the disposable income and you cared, and you wanted to have just kind of a complete set and not mess around, even if you don't know for sure if it's going to work,
right.
then, you know, maybe this is, it's just worth it for not having to go hover on eBay for the next 3 years.
I agree. So. There's another one I just threw into our show notes. There's another IMSI 8080 on eBay right now for $2,500 that is from the estate sale of Don Neller, the guy who wrote the PC, the original PC hack computer game. Looks like it's a working condition. Doesn't come with a bunch of boards, but has a bit of maybe like interesting history to it.
Yeah.
And also will save you a grand.
Doesn't have the drives, but it does otherwise look
nice. It doesn't have ugly white drives.
Yeah,
so
right.
Maybe it's a bonus that it doesn't have those ugly drives.
Right.
So another one. So wow, they're coming out of there and has a neat like kind of personal history that it belonged to Don Neller.
All right. So if you're looking for an IMSI 8080, you can buy one of those.
Or both. And make them play against each other, and then they will learn.
That's right. Maybe the best. What is it? The only winning move is not to play.
Oh, the only winning move is first strike, and then it goes. That was the original ending.
Yeah.
Just ended very badly for everybody. Then Colossus went. I can do better.
All right, let's see. So the next one I have in my list is IBM PC-AT Model 5170. And I don't know what it is. I have some kind of like soft spot for these. I've worked with one for a while. That's why. Actually, I do know why it is. Never mind. But they don't come up very often, and I always look for them. They're always more expensive than I feel like they should be.
Yes.
So.
And if I was getting like an old IBM... this is the one that I would want. Like there's the obviously the 5150, which is in a sense maybe a little bit more iconic, because I don't know. It's the 5170 is the one I would seek out, I think.
Mm-hmm. But they don't come up very often, and they're always expensive. I've never seen one for even $200. I mean, they're always in this. So the one we're looking at now is a buy it now of 600. Plus, eek, for me, it would be 106 shipping. So yeah, but it's a nice set. So if you're looking for one and you have that around on you, it has the nice, you know, manuals and binders. It has, you know, a set of the IBM discs in their sleeves and stuff. And I don't think it comes with the monitor.
Yeah, but the monitors are not that hard to come by.
Yeah.
Although if you get the period one, they're also, you'd want one. Like, I'd want the matching monitor, and they're chunky and heavy and,
right,
but whatever. But they're not super rare.
Right.
But getting this, like, these will, every time it seems one comes up where it's not crazy money, it's like, oh, here's one for $175. It's always like not currently working. And it's like, well, cause it's just like, God knows what's inside this thing. Mm-hmm. So it's always expensive to, and I don't have room for it, but it's one of the ones where if I had like kind of infinite space, this would be among my collection.
Yeah. Yeah. And this particular one, I think it's been relatively loved, you know, so the real-time clock that's normally battery-backed has been altered to use standard AA batteries, so you can keep
nice.
It from, you know, like failing on you. It has...
And it's nice, clean-looking, like the mm-hmm. photos show the inside too, so...
VGA graphics card that's compatible with CGA and EGA, so you could use this. I mean, like, it's a functional computer. If only I had space and this money.
Yeah, because again, yeah, like, it's ain't cheap.
Yeah.
For me, it's, well, $600 US, but it's another like $150 shipping to Canada.
Yeah.
so much money but they're heavy. Like, this is one of those ones where it's understandable. This is not Tandy stuff where it goes, looks like metal, feels like helium. This is like, looks like metal, feels like a car.
Yeah. And then sort of sticking with my PC theme, there's a portable 5155, which is a PC XT and a portable luggable case. And these come up somewhat often, not super often. And this is not super expensive. It's a pretty terrible auction. Actually, it's terrible for a couple of reasons. One, it expires in 2 days. I didn't realize that. So,
okay, well chosen.
Yeah. So it's probably gone by the time you're hearing this. If you read the description, this is basically someone who thought they were getting a tower computer and then realized, oh no, it's a luggable PC.
Right. And those are awful.
They don't know a thing about it. They don't know. He turned it on, or he plugged it in and tried to turn it on and didn't do anything. And he's not sure he even used the right button, but I bet he used the right button because it's a big orange button.
Right.
presumably the power supply doesn't work, it is $150 at the first bid. It's possible nobody will see this before it runs out. And so, you might have another shot at it, but
I have never understood the appeal of these.
Yeah.
I don't get people that like them. I mean, everybody likes their own thing. Most people would wonder why I like the things I like, but I just don't get it. The little tiny screens of these things seem to make them completely useless to actually use. It's basically like, mm-hmm. I want a computer, but I'd rather have an oscilloscope. So can you combine those two things?
Oh, you mean like just portables, luggables in general?
Like luggables in general. Not this one in particular, but all luggables where you get like, I want to have a 150-pound chunk of metal with a 4-inch monitor. It's like, why?
I kind of like the 5155, I kind of like.
I like the keyboard. I'll give you that. IBM makes and made wonderful keyboards.
Well, it's portable. That's the thing.
Is it? Is it?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
Define portable. I mean, every computer other than mainframes are as portable as this thing. So yes, technically, with two hands and a good back, you can relocate this.
Yeah.
You can say that of every desktop computer ever made.
But you don't have to. You don't have to take two trips. If you have to carry a monitor, also you need a.
But a monitor and a modern computer is way less than this. An Apple IIc and its monitor are small. You're still carrying less stuff.
Yeah.
In weight and volume than this thing.
That's true. Well, anyway.
I don't want to disparage your choice, but I'm apparently disparaging your choice.
That's okay. And actually, if you look at the people who viewed this item also viewed list, you can see that there are several others of these on eBay, so you can.
They come up quite a bit. Yeah. The 5155 and stuff. These are ones that I see quite often.
Yeah,
like it's not a super rare one. So I think you can hold out to get one that's in good shape, provably working, nice and clean. It's one you could wait for.
Yeah. Okay, the next one I have is, so this is kind of a weird thing. I'm not going to suggest buying this, but I wanted to point it out. I think this is the same seller as something I just talked about before. Yes, the IMSI seller. But the auction that I'm talking about is a Monitor 3. So it's an Apple Monitor 3. And these are, you probably will have seen them all over the place. You know, so this is a super, it was designed for the Apple 3, but it was widely, widely used for the Apple 2.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of like a long persistence phosphor monitor, you know, monochrome. And every, you know,
what
all
is
this,
that, what does that mean? Long persistence phosphor?
Well, I mean, like it, when a pixel's lit, it stays lit for a little bit, even when the scan line goes away. So it doesn't flicker.
That means not good for games though. Like I never had one of these.
I think you can see the trails.
Okay.
Behind it, behind
you
things.
You kind
that
of
move.
Do that on most CRTs, yeah, in the period. So yeah. I don't think that would actually bug me.
They work nicely in like 80 column mode, whereas some monitors will flicker pretty badly. So they're super common generally.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing I see quite a bit. Yeah, like those are monitors that come up a lot. They were very popular. They seem to have been relatively robust, so lots of stuck around.
Right.
I see them all the time. Mostly I see them on Apple IIs, even though it's a Monitor 3. Like you said, I mostly see this as an Apple II monitor. You'll see sitting on top of an Apple II, kind of fits nicely, very frequently there.
Yeah, and in fact, they made a little stand for the Apple II to kind of like fake the top of an Apple III, so that, you know, it would just sort of like a little hutch that went around the computer that the Apple, mm-hmm, the Monitor 3 sits on.
I got one of those for my Apple II. Because I had one as a kid, so I, mm-hmm, looked around. I finally picked up another one. In fact, I didn't pick up another one. I was given one at Kansas Fest by a lovely listener.
Nice.
Because I had talked about how I was looking for one. I had ordered one. It showed up from eBay broken. Another thing. I'm like, come on, it's a piece of plastic. You couldn't wrap that.
Yeah.
And then somebody at Kansas Fest very thoughtfully gave me one. I still have it, and I still love it.
Cool.
Yeah.
Anyway, and so and this auction has the box that it came in. It looks like it's in pretty good shape, and the manual that comes with it. I actually don't know if it it also came with a little wiping cloth. This monitor has like a mesh screen over it to keep the reflections, you know, sort of anti-glare screen.
Oh, nice.
And one of the problems with these a lot of times is that if it tears even just a little bit, then it's really irritating.
Yeah, I can imagine, because you're never going to not see that.
Yeah.
So what makes this one special? Why pick this one?
Well, okay, so what makes this one special is that it's actually black and white. Most of these are black and green.
I totally think of this as a green screen monitor.
Yeah. So this is, and it has a special model number that goes with that. It's the A3M0006. The green one is A3M0039.
Okay, this has great appeal to me then, because I've always loved the green monitors, but I kind of wish frequently, like I don't remember which one. There's an Apple II clone that had a button where you could switch to monochrome mode. Mm. I don't remember which one it was now, but maybe a few of them, but at least one did. No doubt listeners are already firing up their email, like, oh my goodness, you don't know this, it's this. But anyway, there was one of them, a series of them, and you could switch to monochrome mode, and I always kind of wish that was a standard thing. Sometimes you just don't want to see the weird bleeding and weird, hey, it looks like it's blue, but it's not really blue. Oh, can I just play this in black and white? And actual black and white would be a nice way to go. So that is a lot of appeal to me. I didn't know these even came as a white monitor.
Well, right. It's actually a very uncommon choice, because I think if you were really a business person, like looking at this all day, the green is better on your eye. Actually,
okay.
I for me, amber was always the best.
You're one of those
on
people.
The eye, but
I remember back in the day, it was one of those, oh, amber stuff better on your eye. I'm like, yeah, and carrots are good for pilots or whatever. It's all nonsense.
But anyway, so the thing that makes this sort of exceptional is just that it looks like monitors that are super, super common, but it is actually somewhat rare because it's black and white. And Apple really did sell it like that. It wasn't a replaced monitor, CRT inside or anything.
Oh, right, because the model number tells you, right, okay.
Yeah, so.
But so that explains the cost, because 600 US is quite a bit for a Monitor 3.
Yeah, it's like you would never, ever want to pay this for a monochrome one.
Right.
Yeah.
Cool, so anyway, neat choice. Well spotted.
Something that exists. And this is, again, to kind of go back to like things we've talked about before, if you just found this in, like, if this was something that was in, you know, the weird grandpa's weird attic, you wouldn't know.
Right, that this is like, now the unusual, I wouldn't have known one to look for the A3M0006
right
model number. that is what, but I would never know that.
Yeah.
So, and I probably will forget later.
Yeah.
So sorry, weird grandpa.
Right. So this auction, you probably don't want this auction, but if you really are interested in this monitor, it might not hurt to actually like search for A3M006, because often, you know, people are, they're going to look around, they're going to see, oh, like monitor three, you know, these things sell for $38. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to list mine for $38. And then it turns out that it's the fancy one. So,
right.
So I've gotten one this way.
Only the one?
Only the one. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But at any rate, it is possible to find them. But usually they're the more common green one.
Oh, you know what? Speaking of things, segue nice. That's pretty generally works. It's the Laser 128 and the Laser 128EX.
Okay.
So listeners who paused their podcast and have already emailed us, I figured it out before you told me. That's the one that had the monochrome thing.
Okay.
But speaking of model numbers, that is a trick for eBay. Like I'll frequently do that. Like I'll search for, when I wanted an Apple IIc, I wanted particularly the A2S 4100 model.
Right.
Like that's the model I wanted, just for reasons. And so it can help to search for that, because a lot of times people, especially if they don't know the computer, they'll just put a general description. They'll spell Apple II in a weird way, but they'll just kind of type all the stuff they see on the computer or the box.
Right.
And so it's a way to find like the particular one you're looking for is included in your search, the specific model number or model numbers that you're looking for. Like if you want an Apple extended keyboard, whatever, you might say, but I want specifically like the 115 or the 312 models or whatever, then include those in your searches. It can dig up people that maybe are listing it cheaper because they don't know that's the special version.
Right, right. And actually, when you do something like that, you can sometimes broaden the category so that if you get the person who normally sells postcards, you know, accidentally listing it in the postcard category, but including the model number, you will be the only one who can find it.
Yes, you can buy it very, very cheap. Yes, yeah. I have a couple times over the years, although I don't buy a lot of stuff anymore, but I have bought things from eBay that were listed in the weirdest categories and only found them because I had a search or I did a broad search for something.
Yeah.
But you can't just broadly search for Apple.
No. Then you don't get everything. What you want. Yeah.
Yes.
Although I do have a fairly broad search for Apple II. And that often gets me Apple II stuff, but also gets me, you know, Apple cookbook number two and that sort of thing.
And you haven't started collecting those yet?
I have not, no.
Okay. But,
okay, let's see. The next thing.
I would love to get a list of your saved searches one day. I don't want them, but I mean, it would be like, once you got out of collecting, it would be very interesting to do a discussion show where you're like, okay, I'm no longer buying stuff, so here comes the tips. Like, and so here are the searches that I use to find things. Right? Yeah, because I got a couple, but...
Yeah, they're not proprietary. I can talk about them.
No, but everyone's going to snake away all your special things that you buy.
That's okay. I have too much stuff already. But,
they go to town. Anyway, that'd be an interesting topic. So we'll file away for future topics as well. Which means, listeners, if you got to this part, send in your tips. Because if we do that, I can imagine that being a future show coming up.
Yeah.
I'd be interested in that. Because then you can preemptively, as listeners, send in your eBay search strings or tips that have found you awesome stuff, if you're willing to make it public. And we can include those. You can be part of the host topic. You could be like at the table.
Nice.
Imagine.
Excellent.
Okay, so what else you got? You got a white phosphor monitor that only you knew was special. What else?
Right. So this is the next one I have is a Sinclair ZX Spectrum recreated edition. I looked at this and it's designed to look like a sort of an old thing, but it's actually a new thing.
Oh, I remember them when this came out. Yeah, yeah.
So I didn't follow this up, but on the box it says you can go to recreatedzxspectrum.com for details. Maybe I can even do that now. But it must look like basically a ZX Spectrum that functions as a Bluetooth keyboard. And you can get a recreated ZX Spectrum app that includes a couple of things. Chucky Egg, Sinclair Basic, and a huge game bundle.
Mm.
So it's essentially a keyboard that looks like a ZX Spectrum, I think, is more or less.
And one of the things, like as we talked about before, a lot of people have a real soft spot for these computers. And one of the downsides were... they were horrible keyboards. So it's an interesting idea to say, let's make it and get rid of everything except the keyboard. I mean, it's almost like an act of hatred.
Right.
So it's a weird thing. But I do, honestly see kind of the appeal. Like, you want to use the ZX Spectrum, but you want to do more modern things. And it's like the same reason people will buy the Atari Flashback. It's easier to hook up to a TV. It's got Bluetooth, whatever. And so here's your keyboard. And you use this app and you can like have the ZX Spectrum experience, but not have to deal with older tech. And so I actually do see the appeal. But it's kind of funny that like one of the worst things about these is the keyboard. And that's all you're really getting.
Yeah. I did go and look at the website, which turns out to be, it resolves to sinclair.recreatedzxspectrum.com. So you can sort of get details there. And what the auction is basically just for one of those. So I guess somebody bought it and didn't want it anymore. But so it is a like a $50 bid has already been placed on it. So that is the minimum it would cost. But I don't know if you can buy it now. So there's a little thing on the official site that says initial production run, more than 10,000 units sold out. But there is an order page you can go to. And there's like various different levels, and I don't know what the differences are. So let's just see. It seems like I can get pretty much all the way through to ordering a new one. So
have you just now accidentally ordered one?
At least right now, the eBay auction is cheaper. And it might in fact be the case that you can't order them anymore, but it seems like you can get fairly far through the process before it tells you that.
Okay. So the idea seems to be that this acts as a keyboard. It connects by Bluetooth. It acts as a Bluetooth keyboard. It can connect to like a Mac or a PC or a phone or a tablet. Mm-hmm. And then you run the Spectrum app on that. So it's the app actually doing it. And this just acts as a keyboard that lets you control the games or the software.
Yeah, right.
You get the full experience. So that's pretty cool. I think we talked about this before when it was being made.
Yeah, I think we probably did. But and I probably have most of the same feelings I have now that I did that.
You're consistent that way.
Yeah. So I wouldn't mind getting one. I'm not going to buy this one. All those same things. But
excellent. Yeah.
Okay, let's see. The next thing, very quick note. We had maybe three episodes ago or something, there was a lot of eBay auctions about feet. There are various different feet that you can get to replace the ones that have melted on your computers. And so this is a set of new Quadra 700 feet. For a Mac Quadro 700.
What do you mean new?
So they are in fact newly fabricated to the specifications
like with
the
3D printer
old ones.
Type thing.
Yeah. So, and that seems like a pretty good thing.
But would they be spongy? Because the point of the feet, I think, was also vibration. Like they're like a rubber.
Let's see. What does it say they're made from? Does it say?
Melted down Commodore 64s.
They're flexible, just like the originals too, or at about same hardness. So, and they fit a Quadro 700 perfectly. And
now, one of the downsides is I'm looking at the photos, being like a 3D printer type thing, they are that white from 3D printing.
Yeah.
So they do kind of stand out against the cream color or platinum color of a Quadra. So aesthetically.
Oh, interesting. Buggy. Yeah. You can see it actually attached to it. So.
I mean, it's better than not having them, I guess, but it would still bug me. I'd want to paint them or something.
Yeah.
What if that exists? I bet you that exists. I bet there's a paint. People will say, oh, yeah, you need Benjamin Moore number whatever, and that is Apple Platinum.
Yeah. But then you need to, like, add yellow.
Right. Oh, that's a thing, though. We talked about that before, and something else that just came out that was making me think about yellowing. And last episode, we talked about how, like, the Quadra 800 is, or the 840 AV is particularly bad for the yellow, what part yellow, what part didn't. And I may have talked about this on a show probably, like, 5 years ago. One of the tips that I've always used for figuring out how, because you can't tell, you look at an eBay auction and everything looks fine because modern cameras will just look at it and go, well, what's what? And they just change their white balance.
Yeah.
Nobody goes and takes a proper white balance and then takes a photograph. So you get it and everything looks lovely and white. And then you get the computer and it is just the yellowest thing ever. The trick I often use is if it doesn't have a white thing in the background that gives you proof, look at the shots of the back of the computer because typically the labels will still be white. And you gotta like say you look at an old Mac like a SE30. Say you're one of those people. So the shot of the front of the SE30 will make it look beautiful. Looks just like the color it should have always been. Then you look at the shot of the back and you'll see the white label and the incredibly yellow beside it. That's the actual color of the computer. So look at a photo that has white in it and it won't fool the white balance, the auto white balance in the person's phone or whatever, and you'll get a real feel for how unbelievably yellowed the computer really is. So, because I've had a couple, before I started doing that, I had a couple of surprises where I bought something and went, well, that just looks disgusting.
Yeah. There's a set of Macs that are this shape, mostly sort of the same as the PowerMac 7100, 6100. They're sort of a similar shape in the ones that went all 7600 and later and stuff. But they're, you know, so they're sort of a...
And weirdly, the 7500, which came after the 7600.
Okay.
Bizarre.
But these, like, sort of like a big square box, but that was
it's a great model. Like, it opens up really nice. Like, that was a terrific case.
Oh, yeah. The later ones particularly. I think the 7100 wasn't that. Well, it hadn't quite developed to that, but it sort of has a similar look. You know, like, it's a box, but there's a sort of a front part that sticks out a little.
I had a Power Mac. In fact, we had a cyber cafe as a family once for a while, really huge one, and it had like 100 Power Mac 7600s in it as one of the sections.
Right.
And they were a great case to have. Like the top comes off, and then the whole part with the CPU just like rotates side, like it opens up like a suitcase to get access to everything underneath. It's such an incredible case design.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty sure the episode that David was on, we talked a little bit about this as well.
Our founder.
Yes.
We all have his photograph up behind us. David forces us to keep an oil painting of him. It's just our founder. It's part of the deal. It's right, like it's pain, but
looking down on us.
But looking down on me, definitely.
Yeah.
But as most people do.
I think so. I'm pretty sure that case is called the Outrigger case, and it is.
That sounds familiar.
Wonderful. Yeah.
It is a wonderful. Yeah.
So.
But it's one of those tips. Like I had considered originally picking up. I've considered a lot of computers I didn't end up buying, but I considered, because of nostalgia partly, like picking up a 7600, because it was such a great computer, had like AV options. We used it as a game playing thing, but it could also do like a TV out. And so we had, it was actually used part, you could use computers or you could play video games. And how I controlled access to things like Nintendo 64s and all that kind of stuff, which we had at the Cyber Cafe, is they were routing through a 7600. So it was a computer you could use, or you could say, oh, I want to play a PlayStation, and it would switch over to full screen video of the video into the 7600 and give you access to the PlayStation. It was great. Like, it really works super well. And when I looked into that, it turns out the 7500, which sounds like not as good as the 7600, is actually like the replacement for the 7600. So it's technically, it was like the 72 and the 75 came later. And so the 7500 is technically a better computer. So that might be the one I'd look for, but I get nostalgia for the 7600.
And and this proliferation of models, you know, of course, is one of the things people hate about that era.
Yes, to try to tell the difference between them. It's like, well, no, this one came with the CD, but only half the RAM, and it was shared by the VRAM, and that one comes with a DVD player, but you can't have the floppy. It's like, why did you make 17 versions of this? Well, that was an education-only one, and it comes with a tray that comes out and hits you in the forehead, but you do get one extra meg of RAM. And like, why would you make these models? Like, there's so many almost the same models. Ugh.
I totally know what you mean by the tray that hits you in the forehead. anyway, yes. What was I going to say? Oh, yes. And where all of this was headed initially was that the 7100 had, it was sort of like a metal, there was a metal case that went around it, and then the front was plastic. So there's sort of a front case part.
Well, that must be interestingly yellowing.
Yeah, exactly. So the metal doesn't change color. But the front, so these things always wind up looking like Homer Simpson with like this totally yellow like front, and then a normal. They're very funny looking. So,
and it's weird because you'd look at that case. I'm now looking at a 7100, and I would assume it like opens up and butterflies out like a 7600 would, because it looks like the same front panel.
Yeah, I don't think it's.
But the sides are different, like, so it looks like it wouldn't open up. But the 7600 and 75, the incredible case, really, really good.
Yeah, I think. The thing that came up before also, like I remember noting this, that one of the things that latches some of those swinging parts in place is a little kind of like hard plastic, and it's like a latch, you know, sort of slides one way and releases it, slides back, and it sort of fits in a slot and holds everything together, but that plastic has become super, super brittle, and so I have a number of computers that have Outrigger cases, and how many, many of them have broken that little piece.
So that could be a thing that gets 3D printed as a replacement.
Exactly, like the feet. So if more of those pieces can be made, that'll be even better. And those can be white; it doesn't matter; they're inside.
Right. Or somebody's got to come up with 3D printing squirting goo. You can tell I know a lot about 3D printers because they have a squirting goo.
Yeah.
And the squirting goo should come in, I bet you it does, I bet you it comes in colors already, but it should come in like classic colors. Like this is Atari 800 color.
Oh, yeah. Rather than having to paint things like Charles does. Yeah.
Then you can squirt your goo. It's just like you got a computer and it's the perfect color. And then you just like throw it back in the recycler and say, squirt me out a ZX Spectrum for tomorrow.
Yep.
Totally going to happen.
That's the future.
That's the future. Squirted computer goo.
Yeah.
Excellent. So anyway, people can go online and buy white Quadra 700 feet. Nice choice.
Right. Thanks. Okay. And then the last one I will mention, maybe this one will not take us on quite as many tangents, is a boxed...
Challenge accepted.
Boxed Sinclair QL. This actually looks
super
nice.
What is a
nice.
Sinclair QL?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay.
No, I think,
is it a computer? I don't even know what this is.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I mean, I think it's the successor to the Spectrum.
Oh.
And it actually looks really quite cool. It's in the styrofoam, quite complete. It has the QL computer, QL user guide, power brick. The only thing it seems to be missing, I assume there was a slipcase around the styrofoam that looked nice and isn't there. But it looks like a pretty complete user guide. And the power is a U.S., you know, like North American, I should say, power. There's a couple of cartridges like business graphics and word processor and a database and something else. Actually, there are four more cartridges that you can't read the labels of because it's too blurry. But it actually looks super nice.
It does look nice, silly. I'm looking at it now, and it's all in styrofoam and stuff. And yeah, you're right. This styrofoam sandwich would have come with a slip cover that would go over it, no doubt. But that's all you're missing. But it looks like it's well protected and looks like it's barely, if at all, been used.
Yeah. So if you were looking for one of these, and particularly if you were looking for one in North America and with North American power, this looks nearly unbeatable. I don't think it's been tested.
So it's North American. That's the thing. So it's North American power.
Yeah.
But is it PAL? Because I look at the keyboard, and the keyboard has a pound symbol rather than a dollar symbol. So that screams PAL to me.
Oh, wait. On this auction?
It has a dollar sign, too.
Oh, does it? Where's the pound? Oh, I see. Under the tilde. Yeah.
Because a lot of things come with power that is just universal and can work wherever. But the video signal... Well, it says VHF on it. Does that mean anything to you other than the movie?
Yeah, I guess the movie's UHF, isn't it?
Oh, maybe it was a sequel.
Yeah, right. So that, I mean, it sounds like it, and it has an RGB.
I'd want to know, because if it's untested or whatever, I want to like, is it untested or did the guy plug in and go, I'm getting garbage?
Yeah.
I'm getting garbage because it's a PAL computer that just came over here. Just a thing I'd want to look into.
Yeah, although, I mean, like that may not matter if you're plugging it into a modern monitor of some sort. But yeah, it does look like it says VHF channel 3, channel 4, so it's already going through some sort of RF modulator. And so it is expecting a TV. And there is an RGB plug. I don't know, you know, however many pins it is, 1, 2, 3, 8 or something. So anyway,
cool. I like it.
It looks pretty cool. It's like a $300 buy it now. And so it's not cheap, but it is such a nice specimen. I almost wonder if it'll be bought before the episode goes out and possibly by me.
I hope so. If it is bought by you, then you have to tell us next week.
Yeah.
Or next show.
Right. But anyway, so that's it, I think, for my list.
I like it. Good choices.
Cool. All right. We made it through the eBay auctions, and now there are closing discussions. Neither of us have actually put anything in this.
I have nothing.
Yeah.
I feel like we just recorded the last show 5 minutes ago. I have done nothing since then. My life is an empty shell, and I should do more things.
Right. Okay.
This is the point of the show where I have to look inward and get philosophical and realize my life is just going on and I'm doing less than I should.
Yes. Now it's been.
And how about you?
Well, it's been kind of a frantic, I don't know, a couple of weeks. So just because the semester's ending and as I was saying, the commencement even is today, you know, so I have done very little in that time, but I'm optimistic for the future.
Right. So the lazy days of summer are here, and you will accomplish much before Kansas Fest.
Exactly. Yes, that's the plan.
Good. That's the optimism I like to hear.
All right. So that's good. All right. I guess we can close with that. That's good enough. We've been recording for who knows how long. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, there's only the two of us, so it should be a short show. Oh, look, 2.5 hours later.
How is that even possible?
I may be the problem.
Well,
Without other people here to wrangle me, I just go.
That's all right. I guess that's all right. It gives people something to listen to in the 2 weeks, you know.
So. Exactly. They'll still be listening to this episode when we put out the next one.
Right.
Welcome to the Intellivisionaries.
They're the ones that record all night or whatever, right?
It's like it's like a tantric thing. I think they just started recording in 2015, and the same show is still going.
Right.
They have Sting as a guest.
All right. Yes, that's actually the, that's sort of like the only association I have with tantric. It's always Sting immediately after that. But, okay, perhaps that's enough of that. So I'll close us off. That's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss this in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast, and you can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com, and in fact, you can tell us about your eBay tips and tricks. Perhaps we will talk about that soon in an upcoming episode.
Mm-hmm.
We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net, and please write a review on iTunes. That will help other people find the show. And so, until next time,
Retro Compute!